gleaming white leather apron, and, in addition to their weapons, carry a long-handled axe. In combat, of course, they wear the same uniform as everyone else, but their special skills in the handling of different weapons and explosives make them a sort of shock troop for their battalion. Even in as desperate a situation as Claudine was during the night of May 6th, the impact of that small band of elite troops was not lost. Led by the Foreign Legion sappers, the scattered elements of 2nd Company and of the 313 platoon fought their way back into C5. The sight of the bare-chested and bearded giants was too much even for the tough Viet Minh assault troops of the Iron Division. By 22:30, the legionnaires were back inside the featureless hollow filled with shell craters and dead bodies that used to be C5. It fell for good at 0200, its garrison dead or wounded. But while Puget had won the first round of his fight on E2, and Clemenceau had broken even on Claudine, the enemy was now concentrating on E4 and the tiny E10, which was covering its left flank. If E10 fell, Bréchignac and Botella on E4 would be completely outflanked, and the approach to the Bailey Bridge would be under direct control of the Viet Minh. The defenders of E2 and E3 would be completely sealed off, and the enemy would be in control of the whole hill position. All that would be left of the French fortress of Dien Bien Phu would be a series of half-flooded mud flats filled with wounded and dying, and the wreckage of what once were artillery pieces and tanks. If Dien Bien Phu was to survive to see another day, let alone live long enough to be saved by a ceasefire, the Upper Alliance would have to be held literally to the last ditch, the last cartridge, and the last man. At 2200, the attack began both on E10 and E4. It was a massive attack, led probably with the better parts of two regiments of Division 312 and 316. The first brunt of the attack fell upon its northeastern flank, held by the 2nd Company, 5th Vietnamese Parachute Battalion, which counted barely 30 men. It was not by accident that the Viet Minh chose to attack a Vietnamese unit first, in the hope that it would be most likely to crack. Not only did the little Vietnamese paratroopers fail to crack, but they fought with the cold ferocity that one finds when brother fights against brother. But there were too many enemy troops to be contained by that handful of men. At 22:30, Captain Botella pulled out the remnants of 3rd Company under Captain Phan Vam Phu from the 2nd line and the southern flank of the strongpoint, and reinforced with them the threatened northeastern flank. At the same time, Bréchignac asked Longley to provide him immediately with whatever forces he could scrape together. Since the northern face of Dien Bien Phu, Huguet and Sparrowhawk, had thus far been spared from enemy attack, Longley decided to take a calculated risk by gutting them of the bulk of their troops. Two platoons of Foreign Legion paratroops under Lieutenant Lecoeur Grandmaison and Lieutenant Fournier began the dangerous trek across the whole width of the fortress via the dimly lit tunnels of the subway, past the command post of the GAP, the Castries headquarters, across the battered Bailey Bridge, and through ghostly E-11, which, since it was still theoretically covered by E-12 and E-10, seemed to have no garrison except some wounded and what appeared to be a pack of rats of the Nam Yum. While the Vietnamese had stood off the first enemy attack on E-4, the end now had come for Bijar's own beloved 6th BPC on E-10. There, Major Thomas and his few remaining officers and men were fighting a hopeless holding action. Lieutenant Allaire's mortars were out of ammunition, and his surviving men were fighting his infantry. Yet the most agonizing decision of the last night had to be made by young Lieutenant René Lepage, another paratrooper from Brittany. Lepage's small company held the northern flank of E-10 when the first communist attack smashed into the strong point, and he had immediately requested a flare ship to light up the battlefield around him. In the absence of effective artillery fire, the few remaining howitzer shells were husbanded for really critical situations. The parachute flares were absolutely essential to give maximum effectiveness to the machine guns and recoilless rifles, laying down final protective fires. But high above Dien Bien Phu, the troop transport aircraft had begun their nightly rounds with reinforcements for Dien Bien Phu. There was still the better part of the 1st BPC to be dropped in, notably the whole 1st Company of Captain Fossurier. However, it would have been sheer suicide to begin the airdrop of the paratroopers while the whole battlefield was illuminated a giorno. The choice, then, was between paratroop reinforcement and darkness for 2 hours, at the risk of losing E-10 and perhaps also E-4, or parachute flares over the battlefield and effective defense of the strong points at the risk of running out of defenders later. The only person who could make that judgment was the officer who was facing the threat on the line. Bijard, as commander of all counterattack operations, personally called the young officer on the radio. "Lepage from Bruno. Our friends are above you in the air. We've got to stop the fireflies to drop them. Can we do it?" There was a brief silence, interrupted only by the empty crackling of the voice transmitter as Lepage surveyed the situation beyond his parapet. The Viet Minh were within grenade-throwing distance. Then his answer came firmly over the air, punctuated by the noise of the battle around him. "Priority to the fireflies. Out." Longley accepted the verdict, and now proceeded to scrape together from Strongpoint Sparrowhawk the reinforcements for the 6th BPC which it would need in order to survive. The 8th Parachute Assault had to surrender two small companies, in fact platoons, of 40 men each, commanded by Lieutenant Jacquemet and Lieutenant Bailly. Major Giraud on Huguette was bled of another 60-man company under Lieutenant Michel Brandon to reinforce E4. The gaping holes in the defenses of Huguette were now filled by most of the remaining gun crews from the artillery fighting as infantry. For although Dien Bien Phu still had 7 field pieces, there were only about 600 rounds of ammunition left for them by 2300. On the other hand, faraway Isabelle had 2,000 rounds of artillery shells, but only one single 105mm howitzer left to fire them. By 2300, the remnants of the 6th BPC were cornered in 3 small bunker systems. Major Thomas was with Lieutenants Jean-Élise and Michel Datin, as well as Captain Lucien Lebedec. Lepage was still holding on to the northeast corner next to the road. Captain Trapp and Lieutenant Courbineau faced west near Elion 12, which was still held by a few platoons of the 31st Engineers under Captain Fazentier. To the north of Lepage, Lieutenant André Samalens had held off the enemy for almost an hour with a small platoon. But now he was overrun and dying. Courbineau was killed a short while later. By 0300, May 7th, Major Thomas and 20 men held the communications bunker of E10. The last foothold in the strongpoint. The end had now come for the garrison of Elion 2. There, the fighting had stopped for almost 3 hours, and Bouget's men had used them to dig deeper along their trench line and to distribute the last remaining ammunition. 2 sergeants from Captain Etma's 2nd platoon, Bruni and Ballet, had climbed into the smashed hull of tank Bazeille, facing the southern slope of E2, and manned the 50-caliber machine gun, which was still in operating order. The name Bazeille means nothing to Americans, but to the French, who are inordinately fond of hopeless last-ditch situations in which totally senseless bravery can best be displayed, such as a pearl is best set off by a background of black satin, the name means a great deal. For on September 1, 1870, in the course of the Franco-Prussian War, a French marine infantry force encircled in a farm near the small eastern French village of Bazeille fought to the proverbial last cartridge. The incident did not change the outcome of the battle, but it gave rise to a great many inspirational stories in school textbooks and at least one maudlin painting, naturally named Last Cartridge House. And with the morbid logic of the same type of military mind that made the Foreign Legion's defeat at Camarone a Foreign Legion holiday, Bazeille was promptly made into the traditional holiday of the French Marines. At Dien Bien Phu, the name of Bazeille was to preside over the destruction of French paratroop battalions bearing the old anchor insignia of the French Marine Forces. At 2300 sharp, Strongpoint Elion 2 blew up. There are 3 contemporary accounts by survivors. On the French side, those of Captain Puget, who commanded all of E2, and Sergeant Chabrier, who was with Captain Edma's 2nd company, under which the mine exploded, and on the Communist side, the account of Humay, an officer from Regiment 102 of the 308th People's Army Division. They agree on all the facts, except that Humay states that the mineshaft blew at 2000, thus ignoring the first attack that evening, which E2 had successfully beaten off. Shortly before 2300, Puget was sitting in the cellar of the former French governor's house, which still served as battalion command post on E2. He thought that the Viet Minh, in view of the huge losses on E2 earlier that evening, and the heavy fighting in progress on E10 and E4, would leave E2 alone for the moment, or perhaps try to outflank it. On southern E2, Sergeant Chabrier, who, with a small fire team, still covered the Champs-Élysées slope against communist infiltrations, was almost captured by a lone Baudoy, who suddenly jumped into his trench without having been seen by anyone and called for Chabrier's surrender. He was killed at the last moment by a French paratrooper standing behind him, whom he had not seen. A few minutes before 2300, Chabrier had withdrawn his last outposts from the Champs-Élysées, which was now being churned under by communist artillery and field rockets. On the Viet Minh side, the division commander himself was watching the final preparations for the blowing of the mineshaft and the subsequent breakthrough of 3 infantry battalions. His political commissar stood next to him and again reminded him of the fact that the Geneva conference would begin in 2 days, on May 8th, and that it was imperative that Dien Bien Phu be in Viet Minh hands by then. The commander answered with his own version of Mao Tse-tung's saying that power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Negotiations with the imperialists should be effected by means of bayonets, explosives, and cannon. Tonight we will negotiate with them. The political commissar agreed with him and said with a smile, "That's right. President Ho has said, our soldiers are the best diplomatists. After Dien Bien Phu, surely the conditions imposed by the enemy will change." At 8:10, the radio operators of division headquarters began to check their connections with the 3 infantry battalions of the assault force. Although they now had a sufficient amount of American-made radio sets for fairly efficient radio communications with their forward units, the Viet Minh relied extensively on rapidly strung-out telephone cables, and at 8:05, the telephone operator handed the division commander the telephone receiver with an open line to Regiment 102's headquarters so as to get immediate news of the results of the mine blast. A few seconds before 2300, the commander turned to his deputy chief of staff. "Give orders to fire the petards," he said quietly, then left the trench with the political commissar in order to see the explosion for himself. He, like everyone around him, expected to hear an enormous noise from the explosion. But the 8 hour passed and nothing was heard. Had the mine failed to explode? The political commissar turned to the division commander with a quizzical look, but at that very moment they could hear, against the background of the battle itself, a dull rumbling and feel an ever so slight tremor. Over the open line, the 102nd reported that a bright flash followed by smoke had been seen over E2, but that it was not certain that the whole load had actually exploded. The puzzlement of the Viet Minh was of course understandable. They had never blown a deeply buried mine shaft, and as far as the noise of explosives was concerned, they had only that of French 1,000-pound aerial bombs to go by. Those, of course, exploded close to the surface, whereas their own mine shaft was deeply buried in the hill. After another moment of prudent reconnoitering, the lead battalion of Regiment 102, probably the 69th Infantry Battalion, rose out of the approach trenches. Puget also felt the exploding mine at first merely as a profound tremor, just as a ship which has received a deadly wound from an enemy torpedo still continues on its normal course for an instant before sinking. The same was true for Chabrier, whose position was literally at the rim of the crater created by the explosive charge. He saw a huge geyser of black earth and smoke rising up in the sky, and he, realizing in a flash what was happening, threw himself into the nearest bunker. This saved his life, as the huge chunks of blown-up earth, weapons, and bunkers began to rain down on E2. Captain Edma's 2nd Company disappeared, buried in the rubble, torn apart by the explosion itself, or stunned into total paralysis. But when the smoke lifted and the battlefield became visible again in the shadowless light of the parachute flares, the last remnants of 2nd Company took advantage of the moment of hesitation on the Viet Minh side to carry forward their remaining automatic weapons. The advancing communist assault waves found that the rain-soaked earth of the crater was as slippery as oil and progress agonizingly slow. Sergeant Chabrier and his handful of men, he had 5 with him, including 3 wounded, fired clip after clip into the mass of bogged-down humanity below them. E2, hacked to pieces by 55 days of constant artillery fire and now blown apart by a mine, was still holding fast. All it needed now was some ammunition and a handful of reinforcements. If they could be found, the chaos created by the mine blast could in fact become a boon to the defense. 3 hours later, having been promised the small paratroop force of Lieutenant Le Coeur Grandmaison, Huge himself counterattacked southward over the top of E2, pushing the infiltrated enemy soldiers back from bunker to bunker and hole to hole into the crater. The men of the 102nd knew that if they did not now push the paratroopers off E2, all their sacrifices, the whole miserably difficult work of digging the mine, would have been vain. And Puget also knew that if he failed that night, the French fortress at Dien Bien Phu would be dead tomorrow. At 0300, with the northern part of E2 now almost completely bereft of troops and no trace of Le Coeur Grand Maison and his Foreign Legion parachutists, Puget returned to his CP in the cellar to contact GAP-2 by radio. He could no longer make contact with it, but could clearly hear Brechignac speak to his companies on E4. He also clearly heard Kledik, hard-pressed on the northeastern flank of E4, asking Le Coeur Grand Maison to hasten his approach, and he heard the latter's reply that he was hindered by the deep mud and by hand grenades thrown at him from all sides. Puget knew this meant that he would not receive any reserves. What happened to the various small companies scraped together under fire by Longley was normal. The first unit to go, Jacquemet's, had been caught in the open as it crossed the Nam Yum and had been destroyed. The bodies of its dead were added to those of hundreds of others that were now lying in the water in such numbers that it was possible to cross the river on them. Bailly's company from the 8th Parachute Assault had fought its way across with some losses and had reached E10 at 0300, where Major Thomas was still holding out. There the situation was apocalyptic. A handful of men, under Lieutenants Lepage and Datin, were still counterattacking in order to keep the approach to the Bailly Bridge open. Captain Liboudec, who had also held out on E10 until now, collapsed with an arm smashed by shell fragments. Finally, 0330, Lieutenant Weinberger collected two small platoons of walking wounded legionnaires on E12 and had come to shore up the defenses of E10. But Le Coeur Grand Maison had the farthest to go in order to reach E2, and the whole route now was under enemy fire. For almost two agonizing hours he attempted to climb E2, but in preparation for the general attack, Viet Minh artillery had the strong point perfectly boxed in. After informing Longley of the situation, the rapidly melting band of paratroopers received orders to move to E4, where Brechignac and Botella were again in the process of mounting a counterattack. By a miracle, Master Sergeant Robert and two of the Vietnamese PIMs managed to get through to E4 with six boxes of hand grenades, and the counterattack succeeded. At dawn, E4, save for a small chink of perhaps 20 meters in depth on the eastern flank, was again totally in French hands. Of the small unit that had followed Le Coeur Grand Maison on E4, there remained only the officer himself, his radio operator, and a Vietnamese and a Foreign Legion paratrooper. Of all this, however, Puget on E2 was fully ignorant. He could not understand why, after the incredibly successful defense of E2 thus far, headquarters would abandon him and his companions to their fate. He remembered that Couton had left behind his own radio set with which he could reach Colonel Lemounier, the senior Foreign Legion commander in de Castries headquarters. Lemounier's chief of staff, the tall Major Michel Badeau, picked up the microphone to answer. Badeau, during the 55 days of the battle, had established a solid reputation as being completely unflappable. While others would curse over the radio waves or give vent to despair in the headquarters bunker, Badeau would go quietly about his business, shifting the last remaining units about on the acetate overlay of his large-scale map, asking a mortar battery here or a remaining howitzer section there to expend its last shells on a particularly critical target. But on May 7th, in the early hours of dawn, even he was at the end of his rope. At 0200, the Dien Bien Phu's ammunition stocks were perilously low. There were exactly 100 rounds of 120mm mortar ammunition left, and the remaining 7-105s together owned up to 300 shells, while the last 155, now firing directly 300 meters ahead of itself into Dominique at that moment, had exactly 11 shells. When Kledik on E4 discovered a large concentration of enemy infantry facing him on the slopes of E1 and asked artillery to give him the kind of fire concentration which earlier in the evening had broken up the first Viet Minh attack on E2, he got 3 rounds of artillery support. Huget was now once more pleading for reinforcements and ammunition. The calm voice of Badeau sounded like that of an old teacher trying to explain a difficult problem to a somewhat obtuse student. "Come on, be reasonable. You know the situation as well as I do. Where do you want me to find a company? I can't give you a single man or a single shell, my boy. But that moment, at about 0400, Captain Jean Puget had about 35 men left alive and in fighting condition on the whole hill. Obviously, he thought, further resistance under such circumstances would be completely pointless, and he requested from Badeau permission to abandon E2 and to break out in the direction of E3. There are two versions of what happened next. According to Jules Roy, Badeau is supposed to have said, "You're a paratrooper. You are there to get yourself killed." According to Puget himself, Badeau said, after telling him that he had to fight on, "After all, you are a paratrooper, and you must resist to the death, or at least until morning." There was nothing else to be said between the two men. Dien Bien Phu could no longer do anything for martyred Elian II, and Puget, whose radio operator had been killed, no longer had any need for a transmitter. "Understood. Out. If you have got nothing to add, I'll destroy my set," said Puget. The calm voice of Badeau seemed very far away, much farther than merely 400 meters of shell-pocked mud which actually separated the two men. Badeau also stuck to French Army radio protocol. "Out for me also." "Don't destroy your radio set just yet," said a Vietnamese voice in French. "President Ho Chi Minh offers you a rendition of the Chant du Partisan." It was the voice of a People's Army radio operator listening in on the French command channel. And the beloved words which the French resistance sang in the dark days when it fought against the Nazi occupier could be clearly heard on the command channel. Puget listened to it, from the first verse which spoke of the Black Crows, that is, the foreign occupiers, flying over the land, to the very last verse, which speaks of black blood drying tomorrow on the roads, and ends on the haunting line, "Companions, freedom is listening to us in the night." Then Puget fired three bullets into his set and walked out of his command post. Outside, there was a strange silence settling over Elian II, as one by one, the last survivors of 2nd and 3rd Companies, 1st Colonial Parachute Battalion, were running out of ammunition or were overwhelmed by the slowly advancing Viet Minh infantry. By now, both sides were mostly fighting with hand grenades. As per orders, Puget stayed on E2, slowly falling back northward, past the hulk of Tank Bazaille. He had pulled out the safety ring from his last hand grenade and held the grenade in his right hand. Finally, he was cornered in a trench element. His last handful of men piled all the bodies in the trench as a sort of barricade on one side for a final stand against the approaching Viet Minh. When they were at a distance of 5 meters, Puget threw his last grenade and was knocked down by arriving enemy concussion grenades. When he awoke, he was a prisoner. That still left Sergeant Chabrier and his small band. He was kneeling in a trench giving first aid to a badly wounded sergeant from 3rd Company when the Viet Minh assault force jumped into his trench. As he was being led away, he all of a sudden heard, in the silence around him, the throaty and slow cough of a 50-caliber machine gun. In the burned-out hulk of Tank Bazaille, Sergeants Bruni and Ballet were still firing at the oncoming enemy. It was 0440 of May 7th, 1954. They were firing the last cartridges of Elian II. The Last Day. When May 7th dawned over the valley of Dien Bien Phu, it turned out to be another messy monsoon day, with rain squalls and low-hanging clouds shrouding the surrounding mountain chains. None of the 16 C-119s available that day succeeded in making the run to Dien Bien Phu, but 22 C-47 Dakotas kept on flying supply runs until 1700. The French Air Force seemed to be determined to give Dien Bien Phu a rousing send-off. In addition to the 16 French Navy fighter bombers and one heavy privateer, 25 B-26s and 30 fighters occasionally pierced the low cloud cover and dropped their deadly loads on friend and foe alike. For now, Viet Minh and French positions were so tightly interwoven that it was difficult to hit one without hitting the other, and the whole immediate rear of the Viet Minh positions were now filled with the French prisoners from the units overrun during the previous nights. Major Thomas and Lieutenants Clédic and Lescure Grand Maison were almost killed later that morning by French bombs after having escaped communist bullets for 56 days. They were marching, with their hands tied behind their backs, in the slippery mud east of Elian, in the direction of the deep forest. On what was left of the French position on E4, the situation was indescribable. There were now on the shell-scarred hill almost all the surviving heroes of the French paratroops, Bréchignac, Botella, Clédic, Pam Van Fou, Makoviak, Lepage, and many others. They had withstood the last enemy attack on the east flank at 05:30 and had held on in the north and south. But now, like Puget on E2, they were running out of ammunition. And there were the wounded. Incredible as this may seem, E4 also housed Airborne Surgical Team No. 6 under Dr. Vidal and the first aid stations of the 2-1 RCP under Dr. Jourdain, as well as that of the 5th Vietnamese paratroops under Dr. Rouault. If possible, the plight of the wounded in the niches and burrows on the reverse flank of E4 was even worse than that of the combatants, who at least had fresh air in adequate amounts and stood a chance of dying swiftly from a bullet instead of being buried alive in the collapsing bunkers. Dr. Jourdain was seriously wounded around 06:30, and so were Captains Guilleminot and Pham Van Phu and Lieutenant Lautan of the Vietnamese paratroops. Yet, the stunned survivors could see a fresh battalion of Viet Minh troops assembling in full view on neighboring E1 for another assault. They knew they would not survive it. At De Castries' headquarters, the bad news of the night was being rapidly collated so as to provide Hanoi with a clear picture of the situation. Everybody realized that the situation was bad, but it was not yet judged as desperate. As far as Long Le and Bijard could see at about 0700, E4 and E10 could be held, and E2 would have to be retaken temporarily, if every remaining clerk, typist, and mechanic had to be given a rifle to do it. In fact, Lieutenant Colonel Le Mounier, the commander of the foreign legionnaires in the fortress, showed up at 0700 in full battle gear, having scraped together all the foreign legionnaires he could find. He was going to join Clemenceau on Claudine in order to seal off the threatening gap between Strongpoint Lille and C2, according to one version, or reinforce E4, according to another. But Longley stopped him and told him to wait for the counterattack on E2. If only E2 could be retaken and held, Operation Albatross would be tried the following night. But the counterattack on E2, blasted apart by the mine and covered by dead and dying men of both sides, never came off. General Giap had decided against giving the French any respite. At 0805 began the final communist attack on Helions 4 and 10. At 0900, the communist commander-in-chief called up the commander of the 308th Division, General Vuong Thua Vu, and told him, "There are signs of confusion among the enemy ranks. They may surrender in numbers, but they also made a sudden attempt at breaking through. Give orders to your men to stick closely to the enemy and not to let any of them escape." Finally, a few minutes after 0900, the northeastern flank of E4 finally caved in as screaming hordes of fresh Viet Minh troops, now completely dressed in brand new French camouflaged paratroop uniforms and American steel helmets, no doubt from equipment drops fallen on the enemy side, submerged what was left of E4. Undeterred, Lieutenant Makoviak and a handful of paratroopers held on to the communications trenches around the Strongpoint's command post. At about 09:30, Bréchignac communicated once more with Bijard and Longley. The conversation, interrupted by clearly audible shouts of the last defenders and the screams of the wounded on E4, was of the same tenor as Captain Puget's earlier conversation with Major Vadeau. There was no ammunition and no more reserves on E4, and none to be had elsewhere. The battalion commanders on the hill, Bréchignac and Botella, would stay with their men in the position. Dr. Pierre Rouault would also stay on. Such able-bodied officers and men as would still be capable of it would break out via E10, which was also about to be overrun. Using for the last time the cover nicknames they had adopted for their voice radio communications, Bréchignac spoke first. "Bresch calling Bruno. Bijard. It's the end. Don't clobber us with artillery. There are too many wounded here." Then it was the turn of Captain André Botella. "Petey calling Bruno. It's all over. They're at the CP. Goodbye. Tell that guy Pierre Longley that we liked him a lot." Then a third, younger voice was heard over the set. It was Botella's remaining staff officer, Monaco-born Lieutenant John Armandie. Armandie also had refused to abandon his chief and his wounded comrades on E4, and was going to go down with them as a ship's commander goes down with his vessel. "I'm going to blow up the set," said the young voice on E4, and then the radio waves from Elion carried for the last time the war cry of the French paratroopers, "Hip, hip, hip, hooray!" But it also had been too late for the able-bodied survivors to break out from E4. Lieutenant Le Coeur Grandmaison and his handful of men stayed on with Bressignac on the hill. They were too exhausted for yet another race with death across the fire-beaten approaches to the Nam Yum. Total exhaustion, indeed, had become a daily phenomenon, and Dr. Groan now began to report cases of men who suddenly died at their post without showing signs of combat-induced wounds. They had died of 55 days of not sleeping, not eating, and not resting. But the indefatigable Clédic of the 2-1 RCP tried to make a run for it. Flanked by his two remaining lieutenants, Alberic Potier and Charles Cesarini, and a handful of paratroopers, he literally slid down the muddy slope of E4 into the communications trench leading to E10, but too late. On E10, the Viet Minh had also overwhelmed the last remnants of Bijard's own 6th BPC under Major Thomas. A hand grenade burst near Clédic, stunning him and wounding Cesarini, and Viet Minh soldiers immediately pinned them down. A few minutes later, they joined the officers of the 6th BPC in captivity. Lieutenant Potier was lucky. Having lagged behind during the descent from E4, he was behind a bend in the trench when Clédic was captured, managed to scramble out and find his way to the Bailey Bridge, where two disabled but movable tanks were holding a small bridgehead opened with the help of the Quad-50s from Sparrowhawk. Another lucky man was Lieutenant René Lepage of the 6th BPC. He and two of his paratroopers had crawled through the air hatch in the roof of a bunker on E10 and had jumped across a trench filled with enemy troops. Rolling through the mud of the approaches to the Nam Yum, they had eluded capture. A few seconds later, they staggered into Bijard's dugout, caked in mud from head to toe, and collapsed. Longley, who had lived side by side with Bijard throughout the whole battle, and who had seen him accept unflinchingly the worst setbacks, for the first time saw him react with a sense of personal loss. His beloved 6th Colonial Parachute Battalion, which he had led from the hell of Toulay, where it had been offered up for sacrifice in 1952 to slow down the Viet Minh advance in northwestern Tonkin, and with which he had, on March 28th, taken the enemy flak west of Claudine, had died. Bending down over one of the mud-covered bodies whom only he could recognize, Bijard took its hand and said quietly, "Lepage. Oh, my poor Lepage." In Dr. Groan's hospital, there had also been a sudden influx of hallucinating mud statues, some of them with one leg, all of them naked or almost completely naked under the dirt. One of them was Dr. Alphonse Rivière from the 6th BPC, and the others were some of his wounded. And here again, the enemy had shown some of his surprising frontline chivalry. As the Viet Minh overran the first aid station, they made the wounded get out from among the dead and dying and told them, "Get back to the hospital and tell your doctor that we are coming soon." And as the Viet Minh cleared the remaining trenches and bunkers in bitter hand-to-hand fighting, an enemy soldier suddenly entered the bunker with a hand grenade, the pin of which already had been drawn. The French wounded in the bunker began to scream, and one sergeant, lying paralyzed on the stretcher, frantically waved his two bandaged hands in the air and yelled in French, "We are wounded! We are wounded!" The enemy soldier nodded, turned around, and threw the hand grenade into the open trench outside. Now came the trial of the low-lying Eliens 11 and 12, and E3 to the south. Of those, only E3, again held by legionnaires of the 113 half-brigade under Captain Couton, could be counted on to offer a prolonged defense. On E11 and 12, the remaining tribal tie of Major Chanel and the Moroccan engineers under Captain Fazentieu were, after the destruction of the paratroopers, in no shape to resist the Viet Minh. A few minutes after 10:00, Fazentieu noted grimly that some of his Moroccans in the forward trenches were waving white towels knotted around their rifle barrels. They were to be overrun at 12:10. At 10:00, de Castri spoke to General Coigny over the radio telephone. Although that conversation, as well as the last contact around 1700, was tape-recorded, there exist several conflicting versions as to what was said that day, and charges were made that the tapes were tampered with later on. Existing written transcripts, which this writer has seen, also differ from the available tape recordings. However, there were sufficient outside witnesses to the conversation at Hanoi, including the American reporter David Schönbrunn from the Columbia Broadcasting System, that it is possible to affirm that the sum total of the differing records available indeed gives the full picture of what was said that day. In terse fragments of phrases, his voice pitched even higher than usual, Repeating himself and frequently stumbling over his words, De Castries gave Coni a brief account of the situation in the valley. Most of the time, Coni simply acknowledged the bad news by a grunted, "Oui." The following strong points have fallen: E2, E4, E10, the 6th BPC, the 2-1 RCP, and what was left of the Algerian rifles. "Oui." "Anyhow, might as well write them off." "Oui." For one instant, De Castries lapsed back into an aristocratic mannerism that consists in beginning every possible phrase with the formulation, "N'est-ce pas?" "Isn't it?" "N'est-ce pas?" "There remains at present, in very weak shape, of course, because we have pulled out everything we could on the western flank to shore up the east." "Oui." "There remain just about 2 companies each," correcting himself. "2 companies in all for the 2 BEPs together." "Oui." "3 companies of the Moroccan rifles, but which aren't worth anything, n'est-ce pas?" "They weren't worth anything, that have collapsed." "Oui." "2 companies of the 8th parachute assault." "Oui." "3 companies of BT-2, but that's only normal because, as always, it is the Moroccan rifles and the BT-2 which have the most men left because they don't fight." "Sure." "N'est-ce pas?" "And there are about 2 companies left at the 1-2, at the 1-2 Foreign Legion, and there are just about 2 companies at the 113 Half Brigade. They are companies of 70 or 80 men." "Oui, I understand." "Well, well, we're holding on claw, tooth, and nail." "Oui, we're holding on claw, tooth, and nail, and I hope that by using our means to the maximum..." "Static," De Castries probably said, "we should be able to stop the enemy. On the Namyum." "Hello?"
"Hello,"
shouted Coni.
"Hello,"
said De Castries. "Can you hear me, General?"
"That by stretching your means to the utmost," repeated Coni,
"would be to stop the enemy at the Namyum."
"Oui."
"N'est-ce pas?"
"Even so, we have to hold on to the eastern river bank, or we would be without water."
"Oui,
of course."
"N'est-ce pas?"
Then De Castries described to Coni his proposal for the breakout plan for the following night, and described to him what he knew of the enemy's order of battle. There seemed to be now the whole 312th and 316th Divisions engaged in the attack on the eastern flank, along with regiments 88 and 102 of the 308th Division, with only the regiment 36 of that division remaining on the western flank. Then came the part of the conversation dealing with Operation Albatross, cited earlier. Coni, who had been specifically given authorization by General Navarre on May 5th to approve the breakout whenever De Castries felt that it became necessary, approved it without any of the hesitations he later was said to have had about it. General Pierre Baudet, Navarre's deputy, remained at Coni's side throughout that day. He heard Coni's decision and transmitted it at 1330 to Navarre, who happened that day to be in the ancient Vietnamese imperial capital of Hue. At Dien Bien Phu, De Castries now had to face up to the hardest part of his conversation with Coni, that dealing with the fate of that part of the garrison which could not even attempt a breakout, the wounded, the service troops unused to jungle warfare, and the rats of the Nam Yum.
"Well then, mon Dieu, I'll keep here, well, those units which don't want any part of it."
"That's it, yes."
"Then, well, how shall I put it? There are the wounded, of course, but many of them are already in the hands of the enemy because they were on the strong points Elion 4 and Elion 10. Those wounded..."
"Of course, yes."
"N'est-ce pas? And then, I'll keep all that under my command."
"Oui, old boy."
"That's it, then."
"Au revoir, old boy."
"I'll still be able to telephone you again before..."
There was a moment of hesitation and faltering in De Castries' voice.
"Before the end."
"Come, come.
Au revoir, Castries, old boy."
"Au revoir, General."
"Au revoir, old boy."
At 11:15, Coni sent a brief message, which apparently was not received or acknowledged, to Colonel Lalande on Isabelle. The message, interestingly enough, again contained an ambiguity about whether the Albatross breakout should be attempted, as if Coni had not given Dien Bien Phu the authorization to attempt it just 1 hour earlier. "It is understood that I leave it to your initiative to decide when Albatross should be executed. Stop. Keep me informed of your intentions. Stop. Inform me of any request you deem useful. Stop. If you are without further communication with GONO, the main position at Dien Bien Phu,
you come directly under my orders. Stop.
But while De Castri and Cogny were speaking, Dien Bien Phu itself was disintegrating. Miraculously, the quad 50s of Lieutenant Redon were still firing and still provisioned with ammunition, for they constituted by now the last firebase available to the garrison. Virtually buried under the mounds of spent cartridges, their throaty and regular blam-blam-blam clearly dominated all other sounds on the French side as they hacked away at the communist assault troops now massing on the eastern bank of the Nam Yum. In the west, Claudine was also cracking. At dawn, Captain Koldebeuf had established a last blocking position between Lili, where the last Moroccans of Major Nicolas were holding on, and C4. Every able-bodied soldier was being used, for if the western flank also broke wide open, there would not be enough left of Dien Bien Phu to even attempt a breakout during the following night. Also, Claudine was the strong point that was the closest to the western hills. Until then, it had been the least densely encircled of all the strong points. Any attempt at a breakout would have to go over Claudine or Juno. To the north, the end now was near for Major Touré on Sparrowhawk, and for Captain Bizard's little force still holding on to the nameless strong point in the drainage ditch. At 10:30, they received orders to pull back to a new blocking position just north of De Castri's own command post. Bizard, in fact, was told to remain ready for the planned counterattack on E2. The news that a breakout was to take place that evening had now spread across the camp like wildfire. It also became known that only the cream of the remaining troops would be allowed to attempt it, those in best physical condition, and who had shown in the past their ability to fight well. Each man was to take a double load of ammunition, 2 days of emergency rations, and a tent half, although one doctor, Lieutenant Patrice de Caffour, from the 8th Parachute Assault, would make the break with the column. No wounded would be taken along, and all casualties sustained during the breakout would be ruthlessly abandoned. During the morning, one by one, the breakout elements began to assemble on Juno. In many cases, the choice had been agonizing, and meant leaving behind many officers and men who had fought magnificently. While no one could have stopped him from coming along, it was obvious that Colonel Longley, for one, would have collapsed from sheer exhaustion within the first few kilometers, assuming that he would have survived the fighting of the breakout. Sergeant Kubiak, who had been selected to be among those who would attempt the breakout, went to say goodbye to his wounded comrades from the 1st Battalion, 13th Foreign Legion Half Brigade, who would stay behind. Some of them cried, not for fear of their fate, for it was known by then that the communists did not massacre prisoners, but out of shame that they would have to surrender to the enemy. Kubiak remembered one soldier in particular who argued desperately that he could make the trek. One of his legs had been amputated. What the soldiers and lower-ranking officers at Dien Bien Phu did not know was that a large part of the breakout force was to be deliberately offered up for sacrifice to ensure the passage of at least a small part of it. As the situation developed when Albatross was first actively considered on May 5th, the only path which offered even a remote chance of success was a westward dash into the mountains, provided enough enemy troops could be tied down by other French forces heading toward certain destruction in the direction where the Viet Minh expected them, that is, southward, where Colonel de Crèvecoeur's Condor force was still holding its own. Lalanne's column on Isabelle could be counted upon to head southward in any case. But in the main position of Dien Bien Phu, a life-or-death choice would have to be made. Bizard proposed a simple system, which Longley accepted. Two columns would be formed, one of paratroopers under Bizard and one of legs, as their American counterparts would call non-jumpers, under Major Vadeau. When the decision would be made to break out, the commanders would simply draw straws to determine their own fate and that of their troops. A long straw meant a dash toward the nearby mountains in the west and a chance of survival after a fairly grueling march through 100 kilometers of jungle. A short straw meant a deliberately suicidal attack in the wrong direction in order to give the winners a chance at surviving. At 1200, Longley called the remaining available unit commanders for a final conference in his CP bunker. Bizard, Touré, and Guiraud from the paratroopers, Lemonnier, Vadeau, and Clemenceau from the Foreign Legion. Many of the officers had not had anything warm to eat in days. Longley served them warm soup brought over from the nearby hospital kitchen. Just before they had begun to eat, a French Navy F-4U Corsair fighter had roared low over the camp as it had almost every day at noon, and had dropped a bag of mail, and above all, an eagerly awaited new set of aerial photographs taken the previous day by the French Air Force. Lenglet and Bijard had rapidly looked them over as the conference now began. In a few words, Bijard explained once more the plan of the breakout, which he had dubbed Operation Percée de Sang, bloodletting. However, the aerial photographs dropped by the Corsair had added a new element of desperation to the already hazardous plan. Three new communist trenches now barred the last open stretch of terrain south of Juneau. Even by offering up a maximum of troops, it was doubtful that anything more than a handful of scattered survivors would ever leave the valley. To make that kind of all-out assault against the strongly fortified enemy position with troops as exhausted as those now left at Dien Bien Phu would lead to a pointless butchery. One by one, the battalion commanders confirmed that none of their units was in such shape as to mount, let alone survive, such an assault. That ended all thoughts of implementing Albatross. What remained now was to consider the alternatives. At first glance, there seemed to be two: to capitulate, as the British had at Singapore, the Americans at Corregidor, and even the Germans at Stalingrad, or to fight on, asking for no quarter, as Botella, Bressignac, and Puget had done on the Alliance, as the Americans had at the Alamo, or the Foreign Legion at Camarone. "You can do Camarone with 100 guys, not with 10,000. It was probably one of the Foreign Legion officers present who dropped that remark. Indeed, it was all well and good for the able-bodied men to fight on heroically, but not at the expense of those thousands who now were drowning in the mud of the open trenches surrounding the hospital, and whom Grouin and the last remaining airborne surgical teams no longer could accommodate. Now that a breakout was no longer possible, to resist throughout the next night at the expense of killing or wounding another 300 to 500 men was worse than useless. There was a third way to end the fighting without abandoning the garrison to total chaos, and yet without striking the flag in a formal capitulation, and that was to inform General Giap that the main position of Dien Bien Phu would cease firing at 1730. At 1300, the conference broke up, and Lenglet, accompanied by Bijard, Limonier, and Vadeau, went to see de Castries. Outside, where the monsoon weather had temporarily cleared, the Viet Minh were now massing for the final assault across the Nam Yum. A new assault force appeared to have joined them, troops who until now must have been held in reserve, and who wore brand-new French uniforms. A small group of about 100 communist soldiers tried to wade across the Nam Yum south of E3, where only the wounded from Juneau were defending their position. Sergeant Kubiak, who had just returned from E3, noticed with amazement an automatic rifle team firing point-blank into the communist assault wave. The rifleman wore an extensive blood-soaked bandage around his waist, leaving a bloody print on the ground every time he shifted position. Passing him the loaded ammunition clips was a one-armed soldier, who also wore a bandage around his chest. This enemy attack was stalled by the infantry fire from Juneau, and for a time it seemed as if the tiny strong points E11 and E12, which covered the approaches to the Bailey Bridge, and E3, which still covered Juneau and the Wooden Foot Bridge, would hold out until nightfall. At 1439, there still seemed some stubborn hope somewhere in the valley that a break could be made, as Supply sent a curt message to Hanoi: "Can we, yes or no, count today on low-altitude drops of ammunition? Reply urgently needed." But at 1500, with the most battle-worthy foreign legionnaires having been pulled out for Albatross, the remaining Moroccans on E3 were panicking. Waving white towels or their own unrolled turbans, they crawled out from the trenches in the direction of the oncoming enemy. Apparently, that gave General Giap the cue that the French were no longer determined to hold the other side of the Nam Yum, and that in all probability they had given up any idea of prolonging their resistance beyond the following night. Therefore, he departed from his extremely conservative attitude, and at 1500 ordered the siege force to pursue its attack relentlessly from both the eastern and western flanks. He re-emphasized the importance of a tight encirclement of the French so as not to let any of them escape. In de Castries' bunker, his meeting with the senior troop commanders was brief and dignified. The troop commanders told de Castries what he already knew, that the main position of Dien Bien Phu could not hold until nightfall, and therefore they could not attempt to execute an organized breakout. They also told him that it would be necessary to contact the enemy and inform him of the fact that resistance would cease at a given time, so as to forestall a partial massacre of the disarmed wounded and of the units which had run out of ammunition. In view of the time required to contact some of the now isolated forward elements by radio, and also the desirability of avoiding the chaos that would surely ensue if resistance would cease in the dark, 1730 was chosen as the time to cease resistance. It would be Longley's GAP-2 that would contact the enemy by radio. There was little left to say. De Castries was preoccupied by what would happen to Bijar, whose very name was hated by the Viet Minh. There were many accounts to be settled between Bijar and his 6th Parachute Battalion on one hand, and the enemy on the other. Turning to him, De Castries said, "My poor Bruno, you should try and get away now with a few of your men. The Viets would only be too happy to get you." Bijar refused, and said something to the effect that he would attempt to get away only if it meant a general breakout, but not if it meant leaving his men behind. In that case, he would prefer to attempt an evasion later. For the last time, he rendered a formal military salute to De Castries, then shook his hand, and left the room with all the other officers, save Longley. Upon arriving in his dugout, Bijar destroyed all his remaining personal effects and notes, and then carefully rolled a silk escape map of the northwestern mountain region around one of his ankles. It might come in handy later. At about the same time, Lieutenant Colonel Seguin Pazzi called Colonel Lalande over the radio. In a calm voice, without giving any indication as to what was going on at Dien Bien Phu, he gave the commander of Isabelle the choice of the alternatives which the senior officers at the main position of Dien Bien Phu had just faced up to. To break out, to fight to the last ditch on the position, or to cease fire at a given hour. Lalande opted for the breakout. All this seems a great deal more orderly than it really was, for many of these events took place simultaneously, and Dien Bien Phu did not speak to Hanoi with a single voice, since, as has been shown earlier, several other radio transmitters at Dien Bien Phu were capable of contacting their opposite numbers on the outside. Thus, the radio transmitter with the call letters 9DMO of the 31st Engineers informed the Northern Engineering Command at 1555 that all mail for Major Durieu, its commander, should be destroyed. And at 1610, it asked its correspondent in Hanoi to send telegrams of good health to all the families of the battalion's members in France. Apparently, the 31st Engineers already had been informed of what was coming, or acted on the basis of its role under Albatross, for it informed Hanoi at 1615 that, by order of Commanding General GONO, Engineering Battalion, shall remain on the spot in view of eventual re-establishment of airstrip and for demining purposes. At the headquarters of the Northern Command in Hanoi, where all those various messages were collated, a staff officer noted in the headquarters journal that, "We have the impression that General De Castries is no longer in control of the situation, ne commande plus, as his headquarters cancelled the request for ammunition which it had passed earlier, and now requested exclusively a drop of food rations." At the same moment, Supply repeated its earlier request of, "Yes or no, are we going to get ammunition?" while the air controller at Dien Bien Phu, Major Guérin, reconfirmed to his superiors that ammunition was still a top priority item. But the contradictions were mostly due to the time lag between the arrival of the messages at their various destinations in Hanoi and their centralized collation at headquarters. In fact, Guérin had been called in personally by De Castries a few minutes before 1600 and had been told to call for a complete stoppage of aerial combat support as of 1700, and is switching to food rations as of 1600, with cancellation of ammunition drops already underway. Shortly after 1600, the end came for E-11 and E-12, the last bridgeheads east of the Nam Yum. A brief message was heard from Lieutenant Allaire, the same officer who had been looking for his mortars in the valley of Dien Bien Phu ages ago, on November 20, 1953, when the French had first landed there. Allaire simply said, "They're coming at us without shooting." On Sparrowhawk, the last heavy mortars of Lieutenant Bergot had run out of ammunition, and as he looked behind him at the nearby central command post of General De Castries, he could see dark billows rising above it, and smaller ones at other places throughout the camp. The black smoke of panic, he would call it later. Over on Claudine, where the foreign legionnaires were still holding on to their rain-swamped trenches, a Vietnamese interpreter with the Legionnaires, Sergeant Kim, already noticed at 1500 that the remaining riflemen from the Thai battalions were putting on civilian clothes. Incredible as it may seem, there were still 200 civilians, including women and children, in the fortress, and they were now attempting to flee southward in direction of Ban Co Mai. With them were the 29 native members of Dien Bien Phu's intelligence detachment. They knew what would happen if they fell into enemy hands. There also was on Claudine the Foreign Legion's field brothel. The five Vietnamese girls and their madam had been caught in the middle like everyone else, and had lived through it in underground bunkers as auxiliary nurses, like the Algerian prostitutes, who had also been unable to leave, and had stayed on Dominique. If ever there was a redemption on earth of wayward girls, in the biblical tradition, it had taken place here at Dien Bien Phu. Often the women were seen in the water of a trench up to their hips, waiting to help the wounded in a strong point. In one case, a shell-shocked soldier had developed a fixation that he was a small child and had to be fed by his mother. One of the Vietnamese prostitutes came to his dugout every day to feed him. As the news spread that Dien Bien Phu was to cease fire late in the afternoon, Captain Koldbuff, upon returning to C4, ran into the madam of the Vietnamese brothel. Considering the puritanical attitude of the communists, it was very likely that she and her girls would spend an indefinite period in a Viet Minh re-educational labor camp, from which their chances of release or even survival would be slim. "What are you going to do?" asked Koldbuff to the woman. The madam, looking incongruously normal in the apocalyptic environment of a dying fortress, looked at Koldbuff with her wise and weary eyes, shrugged her shoulders, and said, "Oh, I'll just tell them that we have been kidnapped by the Legion in Hanoi and brought here by force." Perhaps the ruse worked, perhaps it did not. In any case, the Vietnamese prostitutes were never seen again. Of the 11 Algerian prostitutes, 4 were killed during the battle. Most of the others eventually went to live with the rats of the Nam Yum, and all of them later shared the hardships of the prisoner trek. One of them, known as Mimi des Oulad Neils, married a fellow Algerian prisoner in the hospital camp and had her first child in communist-held Hanoi. On Juno, Coutant's small band was firing its last cartridges. Looking out of his trench, Sergeant Kubiak thought he saw a huge white flag flying on General de Castries' command post. In actual fact, it was one of the large white cargo parachutes which had been hanging for the last 3 days on a well-known tree stump left standing near the command post. Contrary to what was affirmed later by one French source, both the other survivors and General Giap, as will be seen later, are in full accord that the only flag which flew over Dien Bien Phu an hour later was the gold-starred red flag of the siege force with the Vietnamese inscription Quyet Chen Quyet Thang, to fight and to win, that had been the motto of the enemy. In any case, that was the last Sergeant Kubiak was to see of the battle. An enemy shell exploded nearby, mangling his right leg, and he collapsed in the mud-soaked trench. At the very same moment, an enemy soldier of the first assault wave jumped across the trench, stopped, looked down at him, and walked back. He slowly raised his submachine gun to the firing position, but as he was to pull the trigger, the ear-shattering staccato of another Tommy gun exploded nearby, and the communist soldier, killed by another legionnaire, collapsed directly on top of Kubiak. The body of the dead Viet Minh protected Kubiak from further harm until he was collected next morning by Viet Minh stretcher-bearers. In Dr. Groan's underground hospital, the news of what was going to happen had first come via Major Touré from the 8th parachute assault, as he was returning from a last call on de Castries before the end. "That's it, Doc. It's all over. At 1730 we cease firing, we cease all resistance. Those who can will destroy their weapons and will blow up the ammunition depots." Like many other officers in that hour, there was a veil of tears over Touré's eyes. Groan turned to his personnel and told them to put on standard uniforms. Most of them, including Groan, had been working in the stifling heat in nothing else but shorts, with Red Cross armbands to properly identify them, as required by the Geneva Conventions. Otherwise, their work continued as if nothing had changed. Groan was to recall later that his very last surgical patient before the end of the fighting had been Captain Leboudec from the 6th BPC, who had been dragged back across the river in the afternoon. Leboudec was lying under sedation on the operating table when the first Viet Minh soldiers entered the hospital. On hearing the commotion, he suddenly awoke and asked groggily, "Are our reinforcements coming in?" No one answered him. At the central command post, two events now took place simultaneously. In his own bunker, Lieutenant Colonel Seguin Fazi, at 16:30, began to personally call every strong point to inform them now of the impending ceasefire and patiently waiting in every case for the full acknowledgment. "By order of the commanding general, the ceasefire will be effective as of 1700. All equipment and supplies will be destroyed." In some cases, notably on Claudine, it was later distinctly remembered that he had added a phrase formally forbidding the raising of white flags. The tone employed by the chief of staff in his last message was deliberately terse and curt. That was the only way he could communicate without letting his listener hear that he was crying. On the secret Z-13 ultra-shortwave transmitter, De Castries was now engaged in a last conversation with Hanoi. He was at first speaking to General Baudet alone, then to Baudet and General Cogny together, and lastly to Cogny alone. At the Dien Bien Phu end of the line, the witnesses were Colonel Longley, who was listening in on the second telephone, and De Castries' own radio operator, Sergeant Millien. At first, De Castries gave Baudet a full picture of the situation at Dien Bien Phu as of 1700. "We're submerged. The three strong points east of the Nam Yum have now fallen. I don't know any more where my wounded are, and my unit commanders are trooping around me asking what to do next. We're now under the fire of the Stalin organs. My men are simply automatons falling apart from lack of sleep." General Baudet then replied, "Let the battle die, and let Lalande make a try for Albatross. We won't let you down. Thanks for the handsome defense." There was a silence at the other end, and then the airwaves crackled again, and De Castries said, harking back to the days of 1940, when he several times parted ways with his German captors, "One can also escape from the Viet Minh." Then De Castries explained that at 1730 he would contact the enemy and inform him that tomorrow there would be Red Cross aircraft coming with supplies for the wounded. It is probably in connection with De Castries' suggestion to send somebody over to the Viet Minh at 1730 under what obviously would have had to be a white flag of truce that the conversation between Cogny and De Castries turned to the problem of not hoisting a white flag. In view of the divergence of the existing records, only a joint declaration by all the witnesses to the conversations on both ends would establish ultimate reliability of what exactly was said. According to the official Agence France-Presse of May 8, 1954, General Cogny is supposed to have said, "You will fight to the end. There is no question about raising the white flag over Dien Bien Phu after your heroic resistance." According to the information received by the French writer Jules Roy from General Cogny himself, that same phrase, although it allegedly was cut from the authoritative magnetic tape of the conversation, ran as follows: "Don't mess up your magnificent defense by hoisting the white flag. You are going to be submerged, but no surrender, no white flag." According to Major Puget, who had been General Navarre's aide and who had received from him the transcript made by General Baudet, the conversation ran as follows: "Tell me, old boy, this has to be finished now, of course, but not in the form of a capitulation. That is forbidden to us. There can be no hoisting of the white flag. The fire has to die of its own. But do not capitulate. That would mess up all that you have done that is magnificent until now." "All right, General. I only wanted to preserve the wounded." "Yes. However, I do have a piece of paper. I haven't got the right to authorize you to capitulate." "Well, you'll do as best you can. But this must not end by a white flag. What you have done is too fine for that. You understand, old boy?" General De Castries understood. There are several versions as to the very last words of the official radio traffic between Dien Bien Phu and the outside. According to the French press agency, the conversation ended with an inspirational, "The transmitter shall be destroyed at 1730. We shall fight to the end. Au revoir, General. Vive la France." But it places a final brief exchange of words at 1730, precisely, in the course of which De Castries said, "I'm blowing up all the installations. The ammunition dumps are already exploding. Au revoir." There is an indication in the headquarters journal that a short conversation of that kind may well have taken place at 1730. All other sources seemed to agree that the conversation ended on a banal, "Well then, au revoir, old boy." It was General René Coigny, the French commanding general in North Vietnam, who had said those banal words as a fitting epitaph for the dying fortress. But a few instants after 1730, the assembled generals and other observers in Hanoi heard a voice with which they were unfamiliar. It was that of Sergeant Millien, who, after 7 months of total anonymity, was signing off and thus entered history. "In 5 minutes, everything will be blowing up here. The Viets are only a few meters away. Greetings to everybody." And the background crackling of the transmitter ceased. In the staff room in Hanoi, the heat was stifling, and that was fortunate, for it was impossible to distinguish the sweat from the tears which were running down everybody's face. The one American present, David Schoenbrunn, who had been a keen observer of the French scene for almost a decade, and who had met with Ho Chi Minh shortly before the Indochina War had broken out, distinctly felt that what he was witnessing here, as day turned into dusk on May 7th, was the end of the French adventure in Indochina, and indeed, the end of the French Empire. But, somehow, this was not the last message to come from Dien Bien Phu. Prosaically, the combat engineers were still passing their traffic to the last minute. According to the records, it was at 1750, or 18 minutes after the last message from De Castries' transmitter, that 9 DMO signed off with a quiet, "We're blowing everything up. Adieu." Dusk. At the news that fighting was to cease at 1730, a veritable orgy of destruction had seized the remaining able-bodied members of the garrison. Each carefully maintained infantry weapon was being fired with the barrel stuck into the ground, thus bursting it. The crew of Tank Auerstedt drained the oil out of the tank's engine and then raced it until it died, its insides destroyed beyond repair. The Viet Minh would later succeed in putting one tank back in operation by cannibalizing parts from all 10 of them, but even that one tank had no combat value. Its gun had no breech block. In the gun pits, the African gunners were methodically smashing all optical equipment and dumping into the deep mud the breech blocks of their pieces. Wherever possible, a white phosphorus hand grenade was thrown into the gun barrel to literally melt its inner lining so as to make the piece permanently unusable. In any case, there was little of the artillery left in a usable state. As we have seen, the American 105s, which the French had at Dien Bien Phu, were known for their extremely vulnerable hydraulic counter-recoil mechanisms, which the slightest mortar fragment could pierce, making the whole gun unusable. That is how Isabelle had lost the night before 8 guns out of 9 inside 2 hours, and in the afternoon of May 7th, there was exactly one single 105 in the main position of Dien Bien Phu, capable of firing. The dispersion of the remaining artillery ammunition in the main position solved the problem of its destruction. A total of only about 300 shells finally fell into enemy hands, and those were stacked too close to a strong point to be safely exploded. At the central command post itself, a strange kind of silence had settled down now that all the transmitters were smashed. A few telephone lines still functioned, connecting mainly the CP with the hospitals, the artillery, and GAP-2. The electricity still functioned. It was never to cease functioning entirely over the next few days, as the Viet Minh realized how important it was for the normal functioning of the camp, whether the French or they themselves were in control of it. After the radio conversation with Coigny had ended, Longley and De Castries looked at each other in silence. There had been many a day in the past 56 when the scrawny, hard-drinking paratroop colonel from Brittany had argued with the handsome, lisping aristocrat, who was his nominal commander, but who was seemingly content to let Longley run the battle by himself with the help of his small mafia of battalion commanders. But in the last few days of the siege, when there was nothing to command, and where the higher courage consisted simply in accepting one's fate with fortitude, De Castries had again come to the fore as a man who was perhaps better than his reputation. These were the last moments of freedom, and perhaps of life, for both men if the enemy proved unmerciful. They embraced, and then shook hands before Longley returned to his dugout to burn his personal papers, his official documents, and finally, his beloved red paratroop beret, which he traded against the anonymous hat of an infantryman. In full defiance, Bijard kept his beret high on his head for everyone to see. If they, the Viet Minh, hated the paratroops, so be it. He was one of them to the end. As the firing died down over the main position, artillery rumbling could be heard and flashes and geysers of dust could clearly be seen rising over faraway Isabel, which was still fighting. The swift, thumping noise of sandal-clad feet could now be heard on the roofs of the dugouts, followed shortly thereafter by a hasty flick-flock in the mud of the communications trenches, and a few seconds later an Asian head, covered with a flat helmet adorned with grass or branches, would show up in the doorway of a bunker. Probably both sides were amazed to find that the other was human at all, after what had happened here for months. The little Asian, often barely a shade over 5 feet tall and hardly ever looking more than 15 years old, even when he was twice that age, would wave a Russian-made submachine gun with its curved ammunition clip and say, "Didi, Malin! Go, go, quick!" Or he would say in guttural French, "Sortez! Get out!" And a new group of Frenchmen, Africans, Legionnaires, or nationalist Vietnamese, but weren't those who had defeated them also entitled to the word nationalist, began their apprenticeship as prisoners of the Viet Minh. The command bunker was taken almost precisely at 17:30. A small 5-man assault team armed with automatic weapons and commanded by a Captain Ta Quang Luat and followed by the squad leaders Van and Chu Ba Te stormed into the command bunker, shouting excitedly the name of De Castries. They finally found him in his dugout, standing erect and impeccably dressed in a clean tan uniform with his bright red spahi cap and one row of metal ribbons. It is not clear whether he